You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 5th, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Where were you 16 years ago?
Yes, happy 16th birthday to the SGU and to all of my fellow hosts.
Wow.
16, yeah. We can drive a car.
16 years.
So
this
bananas.
Is episode number 826.
Whoa.
Yeah, less than 3.5 years or so, we'll be at up to 20 years and 1,000 episodes right around the same time.
But yeah, wow. Really, when you think about it, would you guys say that there are a lot of things in life where you can say, like, you know, who would have thought type of sentiment? Like, you know, you meet someone, you get married, you thought, yeah, I'm going to get married. You know, I should be married to this person my whole life. But this is a milestone I look at and I'm like, for real, I never thought that this project would have taken off, that we would have kept going. Like 5 years, I remember, and I'm like, wow, we did it for 5 years. I wonder how much longer we're going to go. And I was always thinking back then, yeah, we'll probably get 3 more years out of it, 4 more years out of it, whatever.
I don't know. I never had any doubt.
Really? You just...
It's not the doubt. It's more just about the staying power. Like, you know, we keep going.
I kind of figured I was in for the long haul.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, obviously we didn't have any idea. I just didn't know like what the scope of podcasting was going to be and, you know, how just the industry was going to sort itself out. But once we decided to do this, I figured we were just going to keep doing it forever. You know, as long as it wasn't a complete failure. Yeah, just anything other than just like a complete flop, you know, and like going nowhere, which I wasn't counting on. You know, I figured it would be at least reasonably successful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised that we're still going 16 years later, but not to minimize it or to say that it isn't cool. It does take a tremendous amount of staying power. I mean,
oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Putting the show out every week, obviously.
Every week. Come whatever.
Been a huge chunk of our life for the last 16 years of our lives, you know?
Absolutely. Rachel turns 18 this month.
Wow.
So she
life
was
almost
one going
was...
on two.
Oh my gosh.
When this happened. Ugh.
Yeah, it's been my daughter's entire lives, basically.
That's mm-hmm. amazing.
Since you joined, Kara, we've had a lot of growth and we've had a lot of cool things happen, right? You know, like we started the extravaganza, which I think is a ton of fun. You know, our listenership is doing very well. Our Patreon is doing very well. You know, every one of us contributes. But, you know, I also want you to know, Kara, like I really love having you on this show and, you know, co-hosting with you. You're a great friend.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm. I think I've now been I'm right around a third of the lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound about right? Yeah, right around mm-hmm. a third.
Yeah. Yep, 2015.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yep.
Wow.
It's been great.
And Evan, God, I met Evan playing a LARP.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now we're delving into antiquity.
Yes, it was so long ago. But I mean, when you think about like where you meet people in your life and what becomes of certain friendships, you know, it's just funny that you know, look at the pathway when, you know, we met Perry, we mm-hmm. met Evan, you know, and then Kara, we met you at a conference and like, I just mm-hmm. tucked you away in the back of my mind. I like her. I like her a lot. I want to.
Yeah. We all thought the same thing. Yep. Yep.
That's so sweet. So and that conference is now defunct, of course. And we've lost mm-hmm. James Randi too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, so many people have been
so
lost.
So much has
yeah.
changed.
We really started in 1996 is when the Connecticut Skeptical Society was founded.
Yes, it's been 25 years. We've been doing this for a quarter of a century.
25 years, right. That's our point. We've been skeptical activists for a quarter of a century now.
Wow.
How old were you back then, Kara?
25 years ago?
Yeah.
Yep.
I was 12.
She was a 12-year-old.
I was a 12-year-old going on 13. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
You probably would have done well on the show back then.
I mean...
That'll screw with your head though when you think when we started doing this, someone that we would co-host the show with was 12. Like what? Oh my god.
That's weird. And when you started doing the podcast, like Steve, was your daughter even born?
Well, yes. Yeah, both my daughters were born. Yeah, podcast.
But
yes.
Just born, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
oh,
they would have been like 3, you know, 4 and 1. You know?
Wow.
Yeah. When we started podcasting. So they've known it their whole life. They just grew up with it.
I was a completely different person in a completely different life. I was still in a band. I was still in a band where, you know, we were playing twice a week. You know, like that is just a complete life changer.
Jay, it was almost half of your life ago. Think of it that way.
Wow.
I got you all beat. I was the kind of person who would say for the first time ever, hello. Yes, what Bob. Kind of person does that?
Who do you have to be to vocalize that, Jeez. Right, Bob?
That has legs. I can't believe, you know, we still refer to
not
that.
Really?
No, what? It does. Don't even say, Bob, I have not fully
it's totally
exploited that
gimped.
Yet. There's the hello sticker. There's the hello t-shirt. It's all coming, people. Just wait.
All those tags people wear at those conferences say it right on the hello. Yeah, my
I like
name,
to think
you know?
I contributed a lot more than just one stupid, weirdly pronounced word.
You have, Bob first no doubt, but nothing was as funny. Nothing was as
you peaked at hello.
How come nobody laughed when I said hello back then, huh?
Because nobody was listening.
Because nobody was listening. Right. We had an audience of five.
our audience that first year was about 200 people.
That's amazing. And just it's the activation energy. That's the hard part. It's just keeping going when you know that it's such a small group. Because I've known a lot of people to start podcasts. They were like, I did a podcast for like a year. Nobody really listened, so I gave up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, we were happy. I don't remember ever being disappointed by the amount of listeners because we had
never
before that we had the Skeptical Society. We spent a lot of time crafting a newsletter and we'd mail it out. What do we mail out, Steve? A few hundred, a couple hundred of them.
Yeah. And, so it was a lot more work for a lot fewer people. So we were used to it. The podcast was an upgrade, even though it was relatively small by our current standards. And we were happy. Like when we hit 1,000, we were ecstatic. That was like off the hook, you know, for us. In terms of reach, you know, but yeah, it's been a wild ride. I think what's the most surprising part of it, I think, is just all the cool people that we've been able to meet and interview and everything. Yeah.
The learning never stops. It's been a fantastic, fantastic learning vehicle. I consider it my continuing education.
It is. I mean, it's true that there's no better way to learn than to teach. You know, so having to be able to, you know, explain even just a science news item every week or a topic or anything like that is just the best way to learn new information.
Absolutely.
And then, of course,
absolutely,
having it be crowdsourced by 150,000 people doesn't hurt either. You know, we always pointing out and learning new stuff from our listeners. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
I remember early on, we were covering mainly those skeptically, you know, oriented items. And because it was a skeptical podcast. So I remember thinking, damn, it's going to be tough to find, you know, a new and unique item to cover after a while. Because, you know, how deep is it? You know, and in terms of like having a news item, like a skeptical news item come out, that was also, you know, not very common. And then I remember that aha moment when I was like, screw that. You know, I'm going to cover science. I mean, that's what I love talking about anyway. And I remember making that transition in my head. I mean, it's still a skeptical podcast, but this is it's a science communication thing. And I remember that made me very happy because that's an unending pit of awesomeness.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but we did science community, you know, science news from the beginning. So that was more of a change in your head.
So be it.
You become more like space nerdy as the years went on, Bob?
Oh, God, no, I've always been. I remember talking to a girl 40 years ago, talking to her about colliding galaxies. And I was like, and I just loved that shit. I mean, I loved it since, God, before high school. So I loved talking about it.
And she said, I love that band. Yeah.
Yeah, she was like,
right? So I've always loved doing, you know, communicating science. So that was just such a natural fit for me.
And of all the hobbies that I've had in my life, you know, my love for science at this point just so profoundly dwarfs everything else. And luckily, you know, my podcast got to be about something so important, right? So science and critical thinking really are like a freaking cornerstone in my life. You know, like critical thinking is so in my absolute core of who I am. You think about that, guys. You know, think about, you know, just how much critical thinking is your bedrock.
Completely.
But imagine, like, what would it have been if we didn't do the podcast? Like, where, how deeply would it have been seated? I think it wouldn't be anywhere near where it is. Maybe
well,
you
mean
you
mean the skeptical activism in general,
but
But just your overall skills of you know, just skills of being a critical thinker, you know, I have to thank this podcast for making it be, you know, so alive in my mind.
Oh, certainly. I mean, yeah, we learned a tremendous amount in terms of critical thinking. I mean, you know, unfortunately, you can be a physician without being a critical thinker. You know,
true.
Just my profession by itself wouldn't have done it. I'm definitely a better physician. I think a better clinician because of critical thinking. I think that part of it, it's just hard. I can't imagine living my life without critical thinking. It's like I would feel so vulnerable. I would believe so much stupid shit, you know?
Yeah, right.
Like, how can you exist without the ability to sort out what to believe in and what not to believe in? That would be scary to me. You know?
You would need a supernatural power or something to fill those gaps, Steve.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we don't want to spend too much time, you know, reminiscing about 16 years of the SGU, but thanks for indulging us a little bit. It has been a fantastic, you know, thing to be part of our lives. We're happy to keep doing it.
Yeah.
Keep putting the show out. I'm really glad we got to write our first book. That was quite a milestone as well. That's the thing that took longer than I thought it was going to take, honestly. But it's hard. Writing a whole book is freaking hard.
Yeah.
It's a lot of words. But I think the timing was good. I think in terms of where we were in our education, it was good. You know what I mean? I think we had a lot to say at that point. And who knows? Maybe there'll be another one coming out at some point. We'll see.
You never know.
Don't be silly.
All right, let's move on with some news items. Jay, you're going to start us off by telling us about an experimental electric plane.
So we might have electric cars on the road, but electric planes are a completely different thing. You know, not just adding in that third dimension, but the danger levels go way up and the complexity of, you know, just building aircraft that are based on electricity and not on jet fuel. It's a paradigm shift. Did you guys know that electric planes have been around since the 1970s?
I did not.
Doesn't surprise really? No.
Yeah, so that? I mean that's when the first one was created and flown. And in 2015, do you guys remember the Solar Impulse 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? So, yes, yeah. That I remember.
Now, that was collecting energy from the sun and powering mm-hmm. its motors, and it flew solely on electric power. So there's two major problems with electric airplanes. I'm sure everyone can easily think of the first one. That's batteries, right? The weight of batteries, you know, the energy density of batteries, because both of those two issues are, you know, very big problem with batteries alone. And, you know, like there's this cyclical thing, like we've talked about with sending things into outer space. In order to send a, you know, more cargo into outer space, you need more jet fuel, but that adding jet fuel requires more jet fuel, right? And you get to a point of diminishing returns where you can't, you know, you keep adding, same with batteries. If you keep adding a bigger battery, you need more, a bigger battery to support the bigger battery. So we clearly need batteries to have more energy density. And, you know, it's slowly happening. You know, again, no sudden breakthroughs. Also, though, electric planes, and here's the big one, they have to be certified mm-hmm. in the United States by the Federal Aviation Administration, you know, the FAA. And this is largely due to, you know, they have to be safe for passengers. This is a huge undertaking because every freaking component has to be tested and proven airworthy. And specifically the batteries, they're an issue because they're a safety issue because they can catch on fire. You know, legit, like it does happen. You can watch videos on YouTube of people like they're battery in their phone just catches on fire. You know, something happens. So, you know, they have to mitigate these problems, but things are getting better. So in 2016, the FAA approved electric airplanes for up to 19 passengers. So, and it's not a coincidence that in the same year, NASA has been developing an electric plane called the X-57 Maxwell. So right now, the number of commercial electric airplanes is incredibly low, like incredibly low. And I think, you know, we're talking about very small airplanes. I don't think there is a 19. I couldn't find an example of a 19 passenger electric airplane. I think they simply just don't exist yet. And part of this is that the incredibly long and difficult process of getting the FAA to say, yes, this aircraft is approved for commercial flight. So let's go back to the X-57 Maxwell. So the plane will make use of NASA's research in electric-powered flight that goes back to 2014. So back in 2014, they started something called LeapTech, the LeapTech project. And this stands for Leading Edge Asynchronous Propeller Technology. So in essence, this is what this means is that they're figuring out different ways and places to put engines on aircraft, because it's not going to follow the same ways that we create, you know, jet fuel based aircraft. As an example, this plane has 14 engines, and the bulk of the engines are on the wing, So that's it.
It's on the wing.
Yeah. So, all right. So it's an experimental plane. It's centered out of Edwards Air Force Base in California. And, you know, the basic premise here is that it's 100% electric powered. Its first flight is actually scheduled this year. And you might recognize the name of the plane, right? It's the X plane, right? There's been lots of, you know, X planes with NASA. They use that to name their experimental aircraft. And typically those experimental aircraft, you know, either turn into real planes or at least parts of it become something that turns into real aircraft. So this plane comes, like I said, with 14 motors. Now, the cool thing about it is that not only does it have the engines on the tip of the wings, meaning there's a big engine on each side of the plane, on the very tip, the very end of the wing, but there's six engines on each side, smaller ones. And, you know, I was trying to find out details, like why they put the big ones on the outside. You know, what does that mean? You know, what versus the small ones? Why wouldn't you just have a lot of smaller engines? But apparently that as they were experimenting doing the Leap Tech project, they figured out that they can get the most bang for the buck if they have the bigger engines on the far outside of the wings. They call this distributed electric propulsion. And apparently this is going to be something that is very common with electric airplanes. The fuselage that they're using comes from an existing plane called the TECNAM P2006T, and they've repurposed it for the X-57. Now, you might ask, why are they repurposing a fuselage? Can any of you guys guess?
Well, it's already certified fuselage.
Exactly. Because of how unbelievably difficult it is to get these components and new designs approved, they had to start with something that has already been, you know, made flight-worthy. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to note that in the history of aircraft, we've only had one real major shift in propulsion. What was our major shift in propulsion?
Well, propeller to jet, right?
Yeah. So piston.
But what about
to
rocket?
Jet. Well, I'm talking about aircraft, like, you know, passenger aircraft.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. Yeah, they started out with piston engines, right? You think of the old, like, the fighter planes and the bi-wings, all that stuff. Those are running like kind of like a car engine, right? You know, like just a piston-based engine in the front of the plane. Then they went to jet engines, which is a completely different design, completely different way of functioning. And now we have electric motors, and this is coming soon. So we have now we're at the third major shift in propulsion. So a big consideration is that electric planes have to be designed specifically to be electric planes. So even though they repurposed the X-57 fuselage, right? It's a prototype. That's not the way it's going to be. They're definitely going to be building planes from the ground up because of certain things like, you know, fundamental changes like where is the energy source going to be stored, right? So on a jet airplane, the fuel is stored in certain places and it's based off of weight and it's based off of, yeah, you know, like
wing.
Right. But think about it. Like when a jet is flying for a long time and that fuel goes away, If the fuel wasn't put in the exact right place, the balance of the plane would change dramatically, right? Imagine if you had all that fuel in the tail of the plane, and then you burn up three quarters of it. The plane, the weight distribution completely fluctuates.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's the same with batteries, and batteries are really heavy. What they're doing is they're distributing the batteries evenly throughout the plane, or at least one company is working on that right now. And it's looking like this is going to be, you know, something that they do. It's not going to be like the batteries only exist here. They're going to put them in many different places. The X-57 now will be tested with a crew later this year, which is really cool because it's going to be flight worthy to actually put people on it. So one thing to think about here is that electric motors are much, much lighter than jet fuel based motors. So this whole thing is now coming into being, and there's many companies that are working on it. Right now, we have a lot of companies that are out there that are retrofitting, like, you know, using old fuselages to get their technology to the point where they can get some approval and get more experience in the air. I did find a company that's actually building a plane from the ground up, but it's sitting there waiting to get all the testing done through the FAA. So again, even if these planes are built and they're ready to go right now, the approval process could take, you know, 5 years, 10 years. It could be an incredibly long amount of time.
So, you know, do you think that this will replace prop planes that do like short distance travel. You know what I mean? Like, you have like cities that are not
puddle
that
jumpers,
too far apart.
Yeah. Puddle jumpers, right?
Yeah. Which you know, I don't know how often you guys have had to fly on those. It's not a pleasant experience.
Yeah, it's a white knuckle.
Incredibly noisy. Yeah.
Yeah, they there's a lot of things about those small planes that are no good. Like, remember when we flew from the South Island of New Zealand to the North Island and the wind shear was so bad the plane.
Oh, man.
Like, wasn't completely flying sideways, but it was turned to an angle that made you go, what is happening? Yeah, I don't like that. I don't think that electric planes are going to solve like that type of experience, Steve, but it's all about weight and distance right now. How far can an electric plane fly? So, you know, they could fly. I think the max distance they're getting right now is somewhere around 500 miles.
That's plenty, though, for that niche.
But one interesting thing I found out was that when you look at the amount of power output, you know, this is really where the tires hit the pavement here. Right now, batteries just flat out are not even close to being able to put out the energy that they need to. That's it. You know, we're very much below what a jet engine can do. We need the energy.
Yeah,
density.
Jet fuel has a specific energy of about 12,000 watt hours per kilogram. 12,000. The current batteries are like 250.
Yeah,
I mean they're like
Two orders of magnitude. In fact, Steve, like, I don't think a battery technology will ever match that energy density. I think it might be physically impossible. Yeah.
Bob, do you realize what show
you're on? What about supercapacitors? What about supercapacitors?
Battery powered jets. That's just an old memory from something I read years ago. So, yeah, that we could get emails on this.
Yeah, so maybe, I don't agree with that. I think we will steadily increase. And at some point, you know, I'm hoping that we have a couple of heavy hitter innovations that leap us forward. But even if we don't, I mean, we're making steady and good progress with batteries. You know, Bob, and also don't forget, they might be able to come up with more efficient engines. And, you know, there's all sorts of ways to make the energy demands go down.
Nuclear
other than
energy.
Just make the plane light. But we'll see. Look, we're not going anywhere. You know, this is just an update to this particular test, you know, this X-57, the ongoing test. But they're flying people in it. It's made good progress over the last year. And I'm really excited to see, you know, how far that they can take this.
All right, Kara, this is a kind of a different news item talking about the diversity of the World Wide Web.
Yeah, so some computer scientists and computer engineers from different Australian institutions just published a research article in PLOS ONE called The Evolution of Diversity and Dominance of Companies in Online Activity. And, you know, a little bit of it, I have to admit, is a little over my head because it's a really cool multidisciplinary article. So these computer scientists really pulled a lot of information from economics to try and make sense of some of the data that they were able to amass, I think just, what was it, multiple terabytes of data looking across 10 billion posts spanning more than a decade. And what they were trying to do is kind of use this data that they pulled mostly from Reddit and from Twitter, but also from a Common Crawl data set to serve as a proxy for how much attention different sites receive on the internet. So they basically said, we're going to pick a data set. We're going to look at what people are posting on Reddit. We're going to look at what people are posting on Twitter. And we're also going to look across this Common Crawler. And we're going to try and make some sense of where are they pointing to? What are they linking to? And to answer these big picture questions, which is the internet becoming more diverse? Is it expanding or is it shrinking? So I have a quick question for you guys. How many .com domain names do you think there are as of today? Mm. We're recording this on Wednesday, May 5th, 2021,
about
on the internet. Just about 100.
About 100.
I own three of those. Yeah, how many .coms do you think there are?
1.8 billion.
No.
1.8 billion.
120 million?
Yeah, Bob's a lot closer. It's 155, 446, 212 million.
That's a lot.
Yeah, or 155,446,212. That's a better
one. My number was bigger.
But. Your number was bigger. And so Price is Right rules, you lose. Bob wins all the laundry detergent. So there are a lot of .coms. There are fewer .nets. This also polls for some reason. VeriSign tells you there are only 13 million .nets, 13 and a half million .nets. And these are active domain names. And so these researchers were like, okay, there's a lot of crap on the internet. internet. And we want to see how things have changed over time. And really, we want to look at sort of the economics of who owns this sort of internet real estate and where are people spending their time online. So a couple interesting things that they found. Oh, I mentioned before how much data. It was 5.6 terabytes of data that they dug through. And so their Reddit data went back to 2006 and their Twitter data went back to 2011. So they ended up with 5.6 terabytes of data. Let me see, 6 billion user comments on Reddit, 11.8 billion Twitter posts. Oh, I love this. They said that this data set is more than four times the size of the original data from the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Wow.
So what they did is they looked at all of the links to other sites, to other online services. That ended up being about actually more than a billion in total. And what they wanted to know is, you know, how unique is this link? So they did a scale here where we've got maximum diversity, meaning that all links have their own domain, versus minimum diversity, meaning that all of these links go to the same domain. So when we talk about domains, we're talking like twitter.com/youtube.com/, right? So minimum diversity means that all of the links would have been from the same place, maximum that they're all from different places. And they found something really interesting. 10 years ago, there was a lot more diversity across Reddit. So for every 100 random links that users posted, there were about 20 different domains. Now, for every 100 links a user posts on Reddit, there are only about 5 different domains. So we're seeing that these big websites are carrying a lot more of the traffic that people are spending time at. So here's an interesting fact. Between 60 and 70% of all attention on key social media platforms, I'm pulling this straight from the write-up that the authors wrote in the conversation, between 60 and 70% of all attention on key social media platforms is focused towards only 10 popular domains.
Wow.
And we know based on their publication, I'm just switching back to the actual article, that the vast majority of internet data in the West is split between Apple, Facebook, Google, and Amazon. And in the East, their counterparts, Alibaba, Baidu, and Tencent. So we're seeing that the vast majority of this kind of internet traffic is in these specific areas. They also looked at linkage patterns, building these different linkage trees. And what they found was similar, the kind of richer getting richer, the idea that the big kind of mega sites are carrying more and more. But an interesting thing is that this doesn't necessarily mean that innovation has gone down per se. They're actually finding that still at this point, the web is an increasing source of innovation, that technology is ratcheting up, that there are more apps than ever, they're more diverse than ever, but it's also making it harder for people to get ahead, and it's making it harder. There's like an activation energy that's required that a lot of individual programmers, individual users aren't able to overcome because the big players are dominating the field. So we're seeing that even though the diversity of sources is in decline, there's an actual continually increasing functionality within new services. So we're talking about new niche things that we didn't have before, like being able to stream music, like being able to pull from RSS feeds. But well, actually, we've had that for a really long time. But, you know, just think about all of the innovation that's occurring on websites day by day. You know, we're able to stream more terabytes of data. We're able to have more more functionality within these different websites that we couldn't have before. Like Spotify couldn't exist back in the day. We didn't have the technology for Spotify to work the way it works now. WhatsApp, you know, Snapchat, these are things that are built on the backs of technology increases, and vice versa. They also talk a little bit about, the researchers talk about these three kind of like ages. So they do a lot. It's interesting because these are computer scientists, but they must have like backgrounds in ecology and biology because they're constantly comparing or using metaphors for evolution. So they're always talking about kind of species and diversity and ability to overcome selection pressures, which is kind of an interesting metaphor that they use. But then they talk a little bit about what we think of as like infancy, development, and maturity. So think about an organism, for example, in its infancy, during development, and then at maturity. And when we think about the health of nations, we often talk about things like infant mortality. And so they sort of reclaim that term, infant mortality, and they found that there's been a dramatic increase over the last couple of decades of the infant mortality rate of websites. So for example, across their data set, while 40%, almost 40% of the domains that were made in 2006 were still active 5 years later, only 3% of those created in 2015 were active in 2020.
3%? That's all that has survived?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we know that there's a heavy staying power of early adoption, probably back when there was less competition, when the web was less diverse, and once people could get their foot in the door. And you see this a lot with like YouTubers. You see it even with the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, right? Like these early adopters are able to bring a lot of eyes. They're able to have that time scan, that time scale to innovate. And if you stick with it and you're able to overcome certain odds and certain hurdles, we see that the staying power is there. Whereas now the field is really, really diluted and it's become harder. You know, the online competition is obviously really intense. But because of that, unfortunately, there's a loss of diversity. So, you know, they talk about the implications for this. They talk about how this plays nicely with what we understand about basic economics and basic kind of capitalism, right? That we know that competition leads to innovation, but we also know that when monopolies come into play, oftentimes that actually can block innovation. And so we're sort of at this interesting precipice where online companies have a lot of opportunity, right? Like we no longer have some of the traditional rules of capitalist economics, like go into an area that's been lesser served, like a physical geographical area, because the web reaches all corners of the earth. But we do have, we can tap into some economic principles like tap into niche needs. There's increasingly more and more needs for individuals that are small and specific. And so companies that are trying to get a foot in the door, whereas you may not be able to compete with a Facebook or an Amazon right now, if you can address a problem that those companies don't address, or you can reach a consumer base in a way that they don't, you may be able to get your foot in the door and actually find your area within this kind of interesting global competition.
Yeah, and then they'll just buy you out.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, that is sort of right the end stage here. So there is something, I don't know, this kind of research I think is fascinating because, of course, these individuals are coming at it from a computer science perspective, and they did some really interesting computer science juju to try and understand, like, what is the state of the internet today in terms of both its diversity, but also its homogeneity.
Homogeneity.
Yeah, thank you. Homogeneity. But I do think it has so many implications for economics scholars, for neuroeconomics, for psychologists, for business interests, that this is just a fascinating study. And because it's on Plus One, that's the Public Library of Science. It's an open access journal. Anybody listening right now, you can go and read it. Again, it's called The Evolution of Diversity and Dominance of Companies in Online Activity. Just fascinating.
All right. Thanks, Kara. All right, guys, let me ask you a question. When do you think the first multicellular creature evolved?
Multi?
Right before the second one did.
It was that day that one...
It was a Sunday, I think.
So, like Thursday, a billion years ago?
One unicellular engulfed another.
About how long
on that day? Billions.
Billions? I don't know about...
Is it like a billion? Or
I was thinking 1 billion.
Less than a billion.
Maybe 1 billion years ago.
700-800 million years?
A billion is a really good guess. That's really good.
Excellent.
So what is it? So it's probably a billion years ago. So 3.77 billion years is the oldest evidence we have for a single-celled organism, 3.7. So it may have existed before then, but it's at least 3.7 billion years old. So for about 3 billion years, life on Earth was all single-celled creatures, although there's a lot of evolution going on at that time. Modern, you know, extant single-celled creatures and the cells in multicellular creatures are really complicated because it took 3 billion years to evolve that complexity. But at what point did they start, did they evolve into a multicellular creature? So we know when, you know, the Cambrian explosion happened, there was, again, this massive adaptive radiation of all different kinds of multicellular creatures and different body plans, etc. But that's not when multicellular creatures appeared. That's when they first developed hard structures that fossilized. Right. That was when the light turned on. You know, that wasn't when the creatures came into existence. But there was the previous period, the Ediacaran period, right? You have the Ediacaran fauna, which we don't know what their relationship is to the Cambrian creatures. There's some evidence, we talked not too long ago about the fact that there was some evidence that indicates that at least some of the Ediacaran fauna evolved into some of the Cambrian fauna, but it's still not clear. But we don't have a lot of fossil windows into this period of time, and we don't have any documentation of the evolution of multicellularity itself, because, you know, just this is when there were no hard parts. There's nothing to fossilize.
Yeah.
So there's very rare conditions, but there is one place, and there's a few places around the world where we do have, you know, the right conditions. There's one Loch Torridon in Scotland, the so-called Torridonian sequence. It's a large array of microfossils from about a billion years ago. So it's right at that point of time when multicellular creatures may have been first appearing. And there's a particular fossil that they've been studying called Bicellum brassieri. This is basically a sphere of cells, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a blob, a spherical blob of cells. But a recent examination of this spherical blob of cells from a billion years ago indicated that there are two different kinds of cells in there. There's one kind of cell on the outside and one kind of cell on the inside.
Ooh.
So that means the candidate for a multicellular creature, but it doesn't have to be, because it could just be a colony creature. And this is one of those things.
Or it could have been eating, the sphere could have been eating the interior.
The cells on the outside are eating the cells on the inside.
And devour, yeah.
Yeah. That's another question. Did multicellular creatures evolve out of colony creatures or not? But in order to be a multicellular creature, you need one cell to develop into at least two different kinds of cells, right? It can't just be different, you know, kinds of cells getting together. That would be more of a colony.
Right.
But how do we know if these two different types of cells developed from the same progenitor cell? And that's what the
similarities.
That's what the new study shows, because we basically catch the cells in the act migrating from the center to the outside.
Ooh.
And changing their shape as they do.
That's incredible.
The cells in the middle are more spherical. They're more rod-like on the outside. And so we see these transitional cells that are migrating to the outside and becoming more rod-like. So Yeah, it looks pretty good that this is, you know, two different populations of cells developing from a single progenitor cell type, which would make it a genuinely multicellular critter.
Wow.
And pretty much the simplest one that you could possibly imagine, it's a sphere with a center and a shell, and it's like two different kinds of cells. But that's all it takes. You know, once you have that bifurcation, once you have the mechanism of taking different pathways in development, turning some genes on and other genes on versus off, that's it. Yeah, once you have that, then evolution can run with that, right?
Run, baby, run.
Yeah, because then you have that diversity.
Yeah. Then everything else is just a tweak on that process. So, and of course, we don't know if this creature is an actual ancestor to any multicellular creature. It doesn't matter. It's related to it. Yeah, it's at that time when it's plausible, and it's probably, you know, part of a population of things living at that time that were evolving multicellularity. So the question is, so you have, you know, single-celled creatures replicate, but they don't necessarily go on their own way. You could have a population, like bacteria, you know, exist in colonies and collaborate and cooperate.
Biofilms, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So at some point, some clump of cells figured out a way to specialize. You know, you go to the outside and you do your thing, and we'll be on the inside. Multicellularity has its own machinery, separate from the machinery necessary for a single cell to go about its business. Mm-hmm. And that includes things like they have to stick together. There's cell adhesion, right? So that's a huge part of multicellularity.
And they found also, that too, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They did find that as well. There is evidence for the mechanism by which, these cells have cellular adhesion mechanisms, which means that goes along with multicellularity as well. They're not just clumped together, they're stuck together. Mm-hmm. And also that the path of development that they take depends upon where they are three-dimensionally in the organism. And mm-hmm. that, so there's They're sensing chemical gradients, for example. Yeah. They're sensing the cells around them. And based upon what cells are around them will determine what genes they turn on and off and what kind of cell they become. This is just sort of the basics of multicellularity. So we're seeing this being evolved in a very primitive form.
Yeah, this is way back at the beginning of that process.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. But we're just getting a glimpse. We're getting a glimpse of a very complicated evolutionary process.
Could this really be one cell that like at the end of its life migrates from the interior to the exterior of the sphere, but it's still one cell, but it just kind of like it just goes there to die type of thing? Like, you know, like dead skin cells.
Are you saying could the cell have morphed itself as it extended outward?
All right. So I think what you're saying is, do you mean like this, like, this isn't two populations of cells, it's one population of cells of different ages?
Yes.
Like looking at young cells in the middle and old cells on the outside. Yeah, that's
the way we do with paleontology.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I don't know how they would distinguish those two things with the data that they have.
I hope it took
a long time to figure out if we were talking about two different T-Rexes or a young T-Rex and an old T-Rex.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, either way, does this sound like a Nobel Prize to you? This sounds pretty big.
I don't know. Yeah, it's pretty big. I mean, but it's one of the needs a lot of confirmation.
First multicellular life.
Though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's huge.
But you know, keep in mind, it's not like they found a fossil. This is a huge bed of fossils. There's tons of fossils in this location that they have to go through.
Oh, wow. They've
been for years. This is not new. I mean, we've known about this for years. It's a treasure trove of this soft-bodied, fossils from a billion years ago.
How was it preserved?
It's just the environmental fine conditions grain. Were such
super
that,
fine.
Yeah, they preserved these fine soft structures.
Wow, we got to vet the whole planet for stuff. Like
and there's
that.
There's a few of these around the world, of different ages, where there's soft fossils are preserved, and every time we find one, it's like a whole new window opens up into this part of evolution. And there's, again, we're just getting these very brief glimpses at a very long, complicated process. It's just amazing to think like there was 3 billion years of evolution that is like a blip to us.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But it was so important. It doesn't seem like it because we think of it as being so simple. But it was so important to lay those foundations for the explosion later.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, like, when creationists say, oh, what's the probability of a single cell coming together, at random? It's zero, because that didn't happen.
It's not random.
That was 3 billion years of evolution to get to a modern cell, fell, and not just nobody believes a modern cell popped up into existence spontaneously. 3 billion years of evolution.
3,000 million years.
Just
in which a lot could have happened differently over the course of that 3 billion years, that's for sure.
Right.
That's cool. But then you also think that it probably would have independently happened multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, we don't know if this is actually any direct ancestor.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about all the side branches that we'll never know about.
Mm-hmm.
Kills
me,
so cool.
I still hope there's an alien probe out there that documented everything.
That's right. Put it up on YouTube.
Bob, talking about probes, you're going to tell us about NASA's solar probe. The fastest human object ever.
The Parker Solar Probe. Yes, and Steve, as you say, it's a record-breaking machine, having just broken its previous records for fastest man-made object and closest ever approach to the sun. And it's not done breaking these records. And there's other juicy bits of science related to this news item that I'd love to go into. So, yes, the NASA Parker Solar Probe. What is it? Why is it? Who is it? It was launched August 12th. 2018, a day after Jay's birthday. It's the weight of a grown man, say 160 pounds, but it's as big as a small car or a very, very, very large meatball. Depends how you look at it. So it's the first NASA craft actually named after a living person, astrophysicist Eugene Parker. he was the first guy who theorized the solar wind, so he very, very much deserves this honor. The mission is part of NASA's LWS, or Living with a Star program, which I just love that program name so much. Living with a Star, because that's what we're kind of doing. LWS investigates those aspects of the Sun-Earth system that have a direct link to life and society, basically. And, you know, why do we want to do this? Why do we care about this relationship? I mean, it's pretty obvious. I mean, just the science is fascinating, but it potentially could do wonderful things. Like, here's for an example. We could potentially predict the next gargantuan CMB geostorm, like the Carrington event from the late 1800s, that the Carrington event was a coronal mass ejection that came out of the sun and was barely noticed on Earth. But if it happened today, it would be a travesty. It basically imagine every you know, almost every circuit on the planet getting fried, satellites, you know, not literally dropping out of the sky, but completely burned out. I mean, it could be horrific. If we could, this type of research could potentially help us predict events like that, which would be nice because it's going to happen, kids. That event could be the most dangerous event in our near future. More likely over a short time frames than almost anything you can imagine, from a supervolcano to an asteroid hit. It needs a lot of attention, and this is the kind of research that can do it. Okay, so Parker was made to study the corona and solar wind of the sun so we can learn more about space weather. So to accomplish this, Parker has some very cool instruments, four of them on board. It's got a wide-field imager called WHISPER, cool name, and it's got three distinct instruments to study particles in the solar wind. They're mostly electrons and protons, by the way. Plus, they can also inspect the powerful electric and magnetic fields around the sun. So very cool, very precise, very advanced instrumentation for all of that. But to discover what it needs to discover and really break new ground, it's going to have to get really, really close to the sun, because we've been fairly close to the sun before. But we need to get really close with this instrumentation to really get some good detail. So close that some say that this will be the first time a craft actually touches another star, which really isn't that much of a, you know, hyperbole, since the corona is part of the sun's atmosphere, and it will be eventually. It will be in the corona. Now, the tech and the science that makes this happen is where some of those real juicy bits I refer to of science are, and I'd like to talk about those. The first challenge, which is just fascinating, is getting close to the sun. What do you do? What does it take to get close to the sun? It's actually really, really hard, harder than you might imagine. So who knew this? Did you know that it takes 55 times the energy to go to the sun compared to Mars? 55 Why? Times.
It because is, it's farther it's, away, because it's hotter, nope, because it's nope, more radiation.
None of that.
The solar
none of
wind.
That. It's all about orbital mechanics. So everyone,
yeah, you gotta lose all the velocity of the Earth.
Yeah, everyone, right. Put on your orbital mechanics hat, Jay. Not that hat. Put the other one on, Jay. I like that one. It was really cool. Thank you, Jay. So the sun has a lot of gravity. I mean, it's like oh, 90. Yeah. What is it? 98.9 or 99. Point blah blah of the mass of the solar system.
Solar system. Yeah.
It's a huge gravity well, just pulling everything in. But it seems like if you just leave the Earth, you know, just fling yourself off of the Earth in the general direction of the sun, it'll just suck you in. No. Like Steve said, we are in orbit. The Earth is moving at 67,000 miles an hour, about 108,000 kilometers per hour around the sun, which is basically sideways to the sun, right? You're basically going sideways to the sun. So if you launch straight to the sun, you're going to miss it. Totally miss it because of all of that sideways motion. So what you have to do is you have to cancel all of that orbital velocity that Earth gives you if you want to actually hit the sun. And actually, from what one researcher was saying, right now we do not have the technology to hit the sun. We would have to take away all of that sideways motion, which we said we really can't do right now. The Parker probe, though, luckily only wants to get very close to the sun. So it only needs to remove about 80% of that 108,000 kilometers per hour speed. And that's incredibly hard as well. So now going to the outer planets is a lot easier, because instead of canceling almost all of the velocity that the Earth gives you, you just need to add a little bit to it that you already have. So if you escape the Earth at the usual 40,000 kilometers per hour, right? You leave the Earth, escape velocity, you got 40,000, you're going 40,000 kilometers per hour because the sun, the Earth is right, you know, in orbit around the sun. All you need to do is go from 40 kph to 46.6 kph.
No, just hit the accelerator. You're good.
That's it. Just go a little bit faster. Just increase your speed by 6,000 kilometers per hour, and bam, you go to Mars. And then, or, hey, you want to go to Pluto? Go from 40 to 58. 18,000 kph. That's it. 18,000 kph. And you're a Pluto. But you want to go near the sun? You got to wipe out 86,000 kilometers of velocity from the sun, from the earth that the earth gives you. And that's what's really, really hard. That's why it's so hard to get to the sun. Now, of course, God forbid we just build a nice nuclear engine to do most of that hard work for us with just pure brute force. But I suspect it would still be hard, but it would be a lot. Of course, it's a nuclear engine. It would be awesome. So, but instead we have to work with what we currently have. So what they do is they're sending the Parker solar probe to Venus for a gravity assist maneuver. And that gravity assist eats away at that sideways motion. Every time it goes around Venus, it takes away some of that sideways motion. It just reduces it incrementally every time it goes around. So as a result, you have less and less of that sideways motion every time you get that gravity assist from Venus, and that tightens the probe's elliptical orbit each time, letting it get closer and closer to the sun as the probe's perihelion, right, or closest approach to the sun. But not only that, not only will do these gravity assists of Venus help you get closer, you know, to eat away at that sideways motion, but it also, you have the sun pulling you in every time you go back towards the sun, and that just adds to your speed. So two things are happening. You're getting closer and closer to the sun, and you're going faster and faster and faster, faster than anything we have ever launched. And knitting. So
the vehicle has to be able to take the stress of that.
That's amazing. Not only that, I mean, talk about the heat, which I will be talking about. So months after its launch, so 2018, a day after Jay's birthday, just a few months later, and Parker's already breaking records. The records were held by the Helios 2 spacecraft. I think that was in the 70s. That spacecraft also went very close to the sun, and it went very fast. But Parker blew those records away just after a few months. It was already going faster and closer. And I don't even want to tell you the records back then, because who cares? They've already been broken multiple times. But I'll tell you the record that was just broken, and that's why this was in the news this week. Right now, the Parker Solar Probe is the fastest human-made object, 330,000 miles per hour, 532,000 kilometers per hour. That's we've made nothing that's gone faster than that. No material objects. And then the closest a spacecraft has ever gotten to the sun, it was just recently 6.5 million miles or 10.4 million kilometers at perihelion. So the closest and fastest ever. But of course, if you've been paying attention, those records are ephemeral as well, because there's more Venus gravity assists in the future, and ultimately it's going to get even closer and even faster. So how close and how fast is it going to get? Okay. Christmas Eve, 2024, it will achieve its, or around that time, it will achieve its fastest and closest. So it will achieve 430,000 miles per hour, which is 692,000 kilometers per hour. That is fast. Nothing has gone faster. That is 0.064% the speed of light, which actually is pretty awesome. It's 192 kilometers per second. That means it could go around the planet. If you could travel at that speed around the planet, very close to the surface, you could go around the planet in 3.5 minutes. Bam, 3.5 minutes.
Wow.
Little Superman around the world. That is fast. Right?
And yeah, right. And then, in terms of proximity to the sun, that Christmas Eve in 2024, it's going to be 7 million kilometers or 4.3 million miles from the sun. Mercury is 46 million kilometers away. And this is going to be 7 million kilometers away. Super close. It will be within the corona for sure, I think, at that distance. That will be amazing. Okay, so one other thing that really piqued my interest when reading about this, the Parker Solar Probe has the most sophisticated heat shield that I've ever heard about, I've ever devised.
I would hope
super
so.
Cutting edge, yeah, right? It's got to be, right? It's called the TPS, Thermal Protection System. Not very creative there, but kind of very, very descriptive. It's 8 feet. Got an 8 foot diameter heat shield, and it protects everything within its umbra from the intense heat, of course, the intense heat, but also the hypervelocity dust particles that's in the sun's corona. So it does a dual job of protecting that and radiation too as well. The shield itself is a carbon foam sandwiched between two layers of superheated carbon composite. Really cool. And it also, of course, has a special white outer coating, right? That makes perfect sense. You want to reflect as much as you possibly can. So it's got a very special white outer coating. I couldn't find out any details of what makes it so special besides being white. And of course, that will reflect the sun's energy. And imagine if they put Vanta Black on that side of the heat shield. Yeah. Not a smart idea. And then when the probe eventually has its closest encounter that Christmas Eve, it will be exposed to 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 1,370 degrees Celsius. Crazy, crazy hot. But NASA thinks while it's 1,370 degrees Celsius on one side, the happy side of the shield is going to be 85 degrees Fahrenheit or 29.4 degrees Celsius. It's going to be very nice. In fact, it's going to be so cool on the instrument side of the heat shield that the scientists put heaters. They put some heaters on some of the instruments. Can you imagine that? That's, to me, that was hilarious because they're so good at making that shield that they actually had to put some heaters on some of the instruments because it wasn't quite hot enough for maximum efficiency. So I'll just close with my final perception of this heat shield was that this would make what? A perfect dragon shield, right? You're going up against a dragon. Mm-hmm. I want to carry the carbon foam sandwich between two layers of superheated carbon composite. That's definitely what I'm going to be carrying.
Is it heavy, Bob?
I don't know. I don't care. I'll just stay put, wait till the dragon goes away. But I'll make it a sphere of that stuff so I can just stay in there and wait. And then the dragon will probably kick me. But whatever. I won't get burned. I won't get burned. That's all I got, kids.
All right, Evan, we have one more space related news item. This one is about the Chinese space program.
Yeah, it is. You know the old Chinese proverb, what goes up must come down.
Yeah, this one kind of pissed me off.
Yeah, in the case of China's Long March 5B rocket, we're witnessing that proverb come to fruition. This is the fifth iteration of the Long March rocket family, named for the Chinese Red Army's 1934-1935 Long March during the Chinese Civil War. The letter B is used there. I'm not 100% sure, but the B appears to be designating it as a single-stage rocket, whereas the non-B has a second stage and I think a third stage as well. Also, the B is slightly lighter and slightly shorter than the non-B, and the 5B is LEO-specific, low Earth orbit-specific.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, the rocket's coming down. I think a lot of people have been following this on the news. It's been big news all this week. So they launched it because the Chinese are putting a space station together. And this rocket put up one of the key pieces of the space station. However, it unfortunately was not equipped with equipment to control its descent. And it actually reached orbit. And now you can't control it, so it's going to come crashing down. But when is it going to hit? That is the $29 million question. So these rockets, there haven't been many launches. There's been seven launches of these types of rockets in the past, and the first one occurred in 2016, so it's fairly new. The 5B variant, this is only the second time the 5B has launched. That space base that they're constructing is scheduled to be completed in late 2022. It will be a scientific research outpost that China will use for the next decade, perhaps beyond. But the rocket itself that got it up there, well, this is a big thing. Big because it's over 30 meters long. It has a 5-meter diameter. And because it reached orbital velocity, like I said, it's going to come crashing down because they can't control it. This will be one of the, if not the largest, man-made object to hit the Earth or come back in as an uncontrolled re-entry. It is, well, it's not quite, Bob, up to the speed of the Parker probe, but it's traveling around the Earth once every 90 minutes, which is respectable, 7 kilometers every second. So that's pretty impressive. It passes just north of New York and Madrid, also Beijing, and as far south as Chile and New Zealand. They say that it's going around the Earth between the latitudes of 42 degrees north and 42 degrees south. And by the way, do you know where Connecticut is on that? We are 41 degrees north. So we are inside the zone.
Right, so it could land on our damn heads.
It could, but you know what? Chances
job.
Of that happening, Bob?
I don't care.
Statistically?
I don't care. Yeah.
Pretty darn low.
Yeah.
But higher than my chances.
I mean, sure, the odds are low, but the I mean, what is it? A 1 in 3 chance it could land on land? I mean, sure, maybe it'll probably land in the water, but the thing is, they don't know.
They don't know.
How do they not build this in?
This is 90 feet by 15 feet. I mean, this thing is huge. I've heard they've had some stuff fall in previous launches, like on villages, like were they in China or whatever?
Ivory Coast some debris came down.
I mean, this is bad. This is like, this is irresponsible.
Yeah, and that is the point. Bob and Jay touched on it as well, is that, you know, China's, well, as one person put it, they're taking shortcuts that they're not supposed to be taking. You're supposed to take responsibility for the things that you're putting up in space, and you try to mitigate these kinds of things from happening to the best of your ability. But they're just not equipping the rockets with the technology needed in order to bring these things in so that they burn up in the atmosphere as opposed to come crashing down onto the planet.
So this isn't even just like a mistake. This is like intentional. Like, yeah, we're not gonna do this.
Yeah, China.
That's even worse.
Yeah, and they're
that's
pretty
even worse.
Tight-lipped about kind of what's going on. They really haven't even had much in the form of details to say and inform the rest of the planet about kind of what's going on here. But you know, I guess fortunately, other space agencies around the planet are keeping an eye on this and trying to come up with the best determinations as to exactly when it will happen. Now, when you're listening to this, this podcast is going to launch on Saturday, the 8th of May.
You said it's going to launch. I love that.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
It's possible that by the time you're listening to this, it has already come down, and well, may have to do a follow up next week on it. But it could still be up there because it's a moving target. I've seen estimates anywhere from May 7th. The calculations by Russian experts are saying as early as May 7th, but I'm also seeing other agencies say as late as May 10th. I've seen some estimates for May 10th.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. All right, you get the idea.
Smooth jazz.
Smooth jazz, baby. You guys have any ideas?
I don't know, but it got faster as it progressed.
That actually is very relevant.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, it sounds like, I would guess, it's some kind of phenomenon translated into drumming. Like,
all right, well, I mean, you know, that's not that smart of an answer because obviously you're hearing drums.
But so what's making the drumming sounds? So it doesn't sound totally random either. So I'm thinking there's
you're correct. I'll give you that. You know, you're correct. All right, let's get into what the people said.
All right.
So Phil Sumo, he said, "Hi there, love the show. Is this week's noise the Thai Elephant Orchestra?" And I was really surprised to find out about this Thai Elephant Orchestra. What is it? It's an elephant orchestra. Check this out. The orchestra is a whole bunch of elephants playing different kinds of percussive musical instruments, drums, clackers, hitting steel pipes and whatnot. It's fascinating. So just look it up. It's a fun watch. And it's really funny that these elephants are standing there and they're doing it, which I think is just so freaking cool.
Wow.
But Phil, it's not the Elephant Orchestra, although I have to thank you for that. We will move on to Ostrich Man. And he says, "Hey, Jay, I think this noisy is a monkey playing the drums. Best wishes from Lithuania." No, this is not correct. It is not a monkey playing the drums, but it might as well be. And you'll find out why, because it's pretty nutty. You're not as far off as you think. This next one's from a listener named Antonius DeBoer. And he says, "Hi, Jay, long time, first time. This sounded like a drum kit left out in a hailstorm.
That's funny.
Clever.
Lots of people guess that, like weather related, the hail. That could be, you know, it's not a bad guess at all, but Evan did say something very key here, and it's that it seems to get more louder as it goes. I'm going to go down to a new listener wrote in, and this is another clue. Abigail Lubin Weismer, and she said, "Hi, Jay, my name is Abigail. I'm a nurse working in Jerusalem, Israel, been listening to the show since the early days, and I still get excited every Saturday for a new episode. I actually have a guest this week. Yay me. Is it very slow popcorn?"
Huh.
It's not slow popcorn. It is popcorn. It's popcorn that when it pops, it keys a drum kit. The winner for this week, Christian Barrage. "Hi, Jay, longtime listener, first time guestner. I think I have heard this week's noisy. It's a drum set connected to a frying pan filled with popping popcorn. Thanks for the great show." So they hooked up this rig to a frying pan that has popcorn in it with oil, and it's cooking. And as the popcorn pops, it hits different pressure plates above the pot, right? So like, a popcorn hits this one and it hits the kick drum. A popcorn hits this one and the cymbal gets hit, right? So every single thing about the drum kit can get triggered. Mm-hmm. And then, as Evan said, as it goes on and on, it gets faster and faster. Now, I didn't want to play the whole thing because it's actually quite a long sound file, but I will play this popcorn jazz for you. I will play it later on in the file. It kind of does sound like popcorn, mm-hmm. Right?
Sure, it has that cadence.
And I love this noisy because when you listen to it knowing what it is, your brain instantly maps the drum sounds to popcorn kernels popping. But anyway, thank you very much. This original one was sent in by Miklos Bolza. I really appreciate it. That was a lot of fun. I have a new noisy for you guys this week. And this noisy was sent in by a listener named Simon King.
"You know, the very powerful and the very stupid have one thing in common. They don't alter their views to fit the facts. They alter the facts to fit the views. Which can be uncomfortable if you happen to be one of the facts that needs altering."
So I'd like you to identify the person speaking and any other relative information that you think goes along with that. Some of you will know instantly. Some of you will have no clue. Some of you will not make my meatballs this week, which is wrong. Right, Evan?
Wrong answer.
Wrong answer. All right. So if you think you know what this noisy is, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And don't forget to send me any cool sounds that you heard as well. I have a few announcements. I made a mistake last week. I said the Apollo 11 mission had the astronauts on the moon for 8 days. The entire mission was approximately 8 days. How much time did they spend on the moon? Does anybody know?
A little over a day.
21 hours. 23
hours.
21.
21 hours.
We have a series of SGU events. We actually have some really cool stuff happening right now, but there's more than one extravaganza and there's more than one private show. So go to theskepticsguide.org/events to see all the details, and that's it.
All right, guys, we have a great interview coming up with Andy Weir, so let's go to the interview now. Joining us now is Andy Weir. Andy, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be back.
If you recall, we interviewed you a few years ago about your first book, The Martian, which was awesome, of course. Somehow, we missed you for Artemis, your second book, but we managed to get you back on the show for you now. Your third book, Project Hail Mary.
That's right.
Which is going to be released very soon, I understand. And I got an advanced copy and read the whole thing. Let me just say, it was awesome. You know, I think it's fair to say that if you liked The Martian or if you loved The Martian, you'll love this book as well.
But how often do you talk to a writer and say, like, "Hey, I read your book. It sucked."
Yeah, that's true. Occasionally we do interviews with people who are not aligned with our skeptical philosophy. but that's not the case here. So let me just open up with, I'm sure this is like a very common question that you're getting. So how like consciously is Project Hail Mary in your mind, like in the same genre as The Martian? Like how much were you trying to recapture the same sort of feel of The Martian?
Well, I mean, I wasn't going out of my way to do it. I guess that's just the kind of story I turn out. But it shares the concept of like an isolated scientist, right? And mm-hmm. a lot of problem solving. And of course, there's space and stuff. But really, I mean, it deviates from that and not isolated for long. And it deviates from that and becomes basically a buddy comedy, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it is very different in a lot of ways, especially... You know, no spoilers right now, but yeah, it ends up in a different place than The Martian by far, which I thought was really cool, and I did not expect that at all.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you were caught off guard.
So yeah, for our listener, the first part of this interview, we're going to remain relatively spoiler free, but we have to talk about the book, of course, and then we'll let you know when there are big spoilers coming. So it's no surprise, you know, just looking at the cover of the book, you have an astronaut, you know, so you know that this is going to be some kind of a space saga, and there are, you know, other characters involved. So let me ask you about, you, what was the original concept for this book? How did you sort of conceptualize like where you wanted to go with this story?
It was actually pulled largely out of the junkyard of my mind. Basically, I have a mental list of a bunch of ideas for stories or plot twists and stuff like that that either aren't good, you know, aren't good enough to be an entire story, an entire novel on their own, or in a couple of cases when I tried to write a novel, I got about 70,000 words in and then had to back burner it and then put it in the fridge. Oh, wow. And then put the fridge underground. And basically, I gave up on that book. That it was called Jack, and I wrote it between The Martian and Artemis. And it didn't work out, but it had some nuggets of good plot and character ideas. So although it seems like a single cohesive story, Project Hail Mary was actually made of a collection of unrelated story ideas that I had that kind of really fit well together.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack had the concept of a mass conversion-based spacecraft fuel. And then Jack also had a character that was very much like the character of Strat in Project Hail Mary. That's mm-hmm. where Strat's personality came from. Then I had another story idea where a guy wakes up with amnesia and finds out he's aboard a spaceship. And then I had another story idea about... There's just a bunch of stuff that were kind of unrelated. So it wasn't this like linear, like I'm going to figure this out and make this story. It was like, oh, I had this idea. Oh, but I need an explanation for that. Ooh, this other idea would explain that. Oh, okay, wait, you know, and so on. And it came together really well. But it was a series of shower epiphanies of hooking up tubes to other tubes of ideas I'd already had.
So since, at the very beginning of the book, obviously, this is not a spoiler because it's like page one, you know the story starts with someone who wakes up with complete autobiographical amnesia, although retaining their procedural memory. Like they still know stuff. They just have no idea who they are, where they are, how they got there, what's going on. That's a great literary device because then you get to simultaneously.
Yeah, next generation did that in the 90s.
Obviously, nothing's new. Forget that idea. There's nothing new. But it, as devices go, it worked well for this story because the character's a scientist. So you have a scientist starting from nothing, trying to figure out what's going on. So it allowed for that to unfold, which was fun. And then it also, as his memory comes back, we get flashbacks, right? Which is also, yes, of course, that's a super old literary technique, but it works. It kind of all came together well.
Right. Required. Basically, if I told the story, the reason he had memory loss and the reason, well, we find out the actual plot related reason he had memory loss like toward the end of the book. But the reason I did it that way with memory loss and then flashbacks is because if I told the story linearly, it would be really weird. Mm-hmm. Like the first third of the book or so would be them all about them building the ship, and then they'd launch it and you would never see any of those characters again.
Right. Yeah.
And then
right.
And then a fairly critical character wouldn't be introduced until after that. And then It would just be this really, and also the first part, the parts on Earth would be like skimming through time. Like, okay, here's a scene, and the next scene is 2 years later, and then we have the. It would just be this really. It would be like a 5 year old telling you a story, and I didn't want to spend a huge amount of time on the Earth segment, so flashbacks was a really convenient way for me to just give the interesting nice. Tidbits.
Yeah. No, it worked really well. And again, you always want to start in the middle of your story, right? You don't want to, like, oh, here's the day one, you know, and lead up. Yeah, the linear, you know, model would not have worked for this story.
Born in 1972.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's, oh, yeah, the best stories always start, like, in the middle of the action where you don't know what's going on. You kind of have to figure it out as you go along. All right, so let's transition to the more spoiler section of the
Please.
Interview. So if you don't,
spoiler level two.
Yeah, we're spoiler level two. So if you don't, you know, for the listener, if you really don't want to hear any spoilers beyond what we've already said, I highly recommend the book. Just get it and read it, and then you could listen to this at a later time. It's a quick read too. I mean, it's very breezy. Once you get into it, I think I read it in like 3 or 4 days.
Or alternatively, you can listen to this entire interview, but then erase your memory.
Yeah, you could do that.
So, Andy, your protagonist is very different than your protagonist in The Martian. So this is someone who really didn't even want to be there. Like the attitude is very different.
Yeah. He was not anyone's first choice for this mission, especially not his own.
Right.
He would rather not be there, and the powers that be would rather he weren't there. But he was really. It ended up. Events conspired that he had to go. He was the one who had to be on it, mainly because since we're in pseudo spoiler. So basically, it's an interstellar mission. I guess go back a little bit further. Since we're in spoiler, I can lay out the premise. An alien microbe that human scientists end up naming astrophage enters our solar system and starts breeding on the sun. This is how astrophage works. It lives on a star, the surface of a star, and it collects energy. There's a lot of energy.
What part of the star, like within like the chromosphere or closer? Or
near the surface, so kind of in the corona. I guess you could say it's a coronal virus. But,
nice. No, that's it.
I'm pretty damn funny.
No, I like that.
By the way, I wrote this whole book before COVID happened. Like, I was done before the virus, before the pandemic happened. Anyway, so it lives in the on the surface of the sun, and it's a microbe. It's like the size of a bacteria, and it gathers in a lot of energy and stores it actually as mass internally. So it's converting heat into mass, and then it turns that mass energy into light that it uses as propulsion, because light actually, you know, light has momentum. If you shine light out the back of your butt, if you're a microbe, then you will be pushed forward, although not fast. But they are doing mass conversion, and that turns out to be a good amount of force. And so where do they go? Well, they go to a planet nearby that'll have carbon dioxide, whatever the nearest major source of carbon dioxide is, and they go there, and then that's how they reproduce. They do mitosis, because the star itself will just have hydrogen and helium. It needs it needs heavier atoms to be able to make a copy of itself. So it does that, and then the parent cell and the daughter cell both go back to the star, and that's the cycle of life. Also, frequently, the astrophage will just shoot out away from the star. You know, instead of doing the normal breeding, it'll just shoot out in a random direction and just go. And this is how it spores, and it'll spread from star to star this way. It can actually survive an interstellar trip. So it's basically like algae in the ocean. It just breeds. It's not intelligent. It doesn't have an agenda. It's just doing its thing. So astrophage ends up growing on our sun. And this causes a very significant problem, because it's growing out of control. It's just doubling its population every whatever time period. And the sun is starting to get dimmer. Scientists notice initially that the sun's getting dimmer, and then they realize that astrophage is doing it. And then I'm skimming over a lot of stuff here. But then they realize that, okay, all the stars in our local area of stars are getting dimmer except Tau Ceti. Why isn't Tau City getting dimmer? Well, they decide to make an interstellar mission to find out why, because they hope to be able to reproduce that here to save all of humanity. Because if the sun gets too dim, life on Earth is going to die.
Yep.
So astrophage is the cause and solution to this problem, because they can harvest astrophage, farm it, and use it as a propulsion for an interstellar ship. So that's what they do. And our hero, Ryland Grace, is aboard the Hail Mary. That's the name of the ship, because this is a desperate pass, you know, a desperate attempt to save humanity. Where he wakes up, he's in the Tau City system.
Yeah.
For anybody who decided, hey, I want to ruin this book, I'm going to blow through the spoiler warning. Well, that's the premise. There's a lot more that happens. It's not too late to fuck off and go read the book.
All right, but I do need to introduce one more spoiler because we didn't really talk about this.
I don't know how far you guys are.
Well, the one I really want to talk to you about is Rocky.
We are entering spoiler level three.
Yeah, it's definitely spoiler level three. So in Tau Ceti, our hero, Ryland Grace, encounters an alien who is from another nearby star, Epsilon Eridani, who's also dying. And, right, was that the right one, Epsilon Eridani?
Not Epsilon Eridani, yes. It's 40 Eridani.
No, 40 Eridani. Oh, yeah, sorry, but it's Eridani. And then he, they're also sending their own Hail Mary to the same system to figure out the same problem, and then the two of them end up working together. So I have to tell you, what I love about Rocky is that he's an actual alien, right? Which is a big...
Like, not a humanoid with two arms, two legs.
It's not a humanoid alien. Yeah, so you must have set out to create, like, as different an entity as you possibly could. I mean, how deliberate was that?
Deliberate.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I'm sick of, like, oh, hey, what do you know? This alien life form that evolved on another planet with no correlation with Earth happens to be perfectly comfortable in Earth's atmosphere, atmospheric pressure, temperature, radiation levels.
Mm-hmm. You should have just made him exactly human except for a weird thing on his nose and maybe his
and a mustache.
Good enough.
I was thinking female, blue skin, not a lot of clothing, yes. Needs to learn more about this thing you call lovemaking.
Yeah. That's the 1950s version of your book.
Yeah.
And it also happens to be my current fantasy, but go on.
There we go.
So we got two life forms within, two spacefaring life forms within 17 light years of each other. That's pretty good.
Yeah, well, that is pretty unlikely. And so I do explain that somewhat in the book, in that we find out that life, all of the life, they actually find three biological worlds, for lack of a better term, three life worlds. There's Earth, and then there's Rocky's home world, of which Rocky's language is not pronounceable by humans, and so our protagonist, Ryland, has to name everything. And so Rocky's homeworld, he names it Arid, because it's in Eridani, and he calls the species Iridian. And so also there's a planet in orbit around Tau Ceti that they name Adrian. Adrian, Earth, and Arid are all, you know, have their own, like, complex full biosphere that are incompatible with each other's biospheres, but they were all
defeated each other.
Well, Tau Ceti, the planet Adrian, is where life evolved originally, and a progenitor species to astrophage, an ancestor like 4 billion years ago, was out was spreading out, similar to how astrophage does, but not nearly as effectively. And it ended up seeding a bunch of planets with life. It wasn't like it had an objective. It was just it would fan out and try to, you know, breed on stars and stuff like that. And, you know,
panspermia.
And it was a panspermia. So it's nice for me, the writer, because I didn't have to invent life because I'm not God. So I could just say, like, oh, yeah, they, you know, astrophage and Rocky, if you look at their cells, they have mitochondria, ribosomes, DNA, you know, all the same building blocks. And so in terms of, you know, there being life so close together, that's why the life is so close together. Yeah, there was only one genesis. And they also say, like, Rocky and Ryland at one point are talking, and they speculate on, like, why is it that we're both here? Like, how come both of our species are at the almost the exact same level of development? Like, if you think about it, we had, like, you know, a couple billion years or several billion years with no contact, and now here we are, and we have very, very similar levels of technology. In fact, the Iridians are significantly behind. They're a couple of centuries behind us in terms of technology, really. It's just they have some spiky bits of technology in terms of material science.
Material science, yeah.
And Rocky answers with his own theory, which I won't try to say it with his accent, but he basically says, well, there could be lots of species. There could be lots of intelligent species encountering astrophage, and the ones who are a few centuries behind us technologically don't have the technology to address it this way. They're just going to stay on their planet and probably die, right? And the ones who are a few centuries ahead of us in technology would probably be able to, yeah, solve the problem without having to come here. So it's sort of a filter. The only people who would come to Tau Ceti are the species that have this narrow range of technological advancement.
No, makes sense.
So there.
It's as good an explanation as anything. Yeah. But that's what I like about the book. It's like, obviously, you have to make some concessions to the narrative. Like Jay and I were talking about tonight. Again, why Rocky is extremely alien, he has to be relatable enough. You know what I mean? He's got to think enough like a person that he can be a character. And the hardest thing to do is to make aliens that think alien, you know? And it's hard to tell stories about them because, you know, they're kind of inaccessible.
Yeah, and so what I decided was I just kind of, when designing Iridians in general, I had to design their physiology, which was a lot of fun because I actually started that. Well, I'll tell you about that in a minute, but that was really cool. But then I also needed to design their kind of what their personalities are like, exactly like you said. It's like they, you know, what are their alien thought processes? How do they think? What is their society like? So I started off by, in terms of social stuff, I started off by making a list of everything that is required for a life form to develop space travel. I'm like, okay, well, first off, They need a certain minimum intelligence, right? They need to be able to understand things, look at things, build on that understanding. They also need language because no one, or unless they're unbelievably intelligent, it's not possible for a single entity to work all this stuff out, right? And they also need to have some sort of pack instinct so that they can have a civilization. You know, so they can't be like bears who just avoid each other all year except for when mating, right? And so I started working on stuff like that. And you end up with the idea of like just having a pack instinct at all, you get an awful lot of the behaviors that you think of as being human. And you see that in the animal kingdom everywhere. You see like dogs will have kind of their best friend dog, you know? And yeah. Primates, of course, are the primates because we're primates, so no surprise there. But everything that has packs, they'll hang out. So they have a pack. That's their little civilization. And then they will have favorites within the pack. And then they'll and so on. And it's the same pattern over and over again, each time individually evolved. So I think it's reasonable to say, all right, the aliens do it too.
Andy, did you crowdsource at all for this, like the Martian?
I didn't. And also, it's kind of overstated how much I crowdsource the Martian. I didn't like, it's not like we played a big game of round robin. As I wrote the Martian, I was posting my chapters to my website, and my readers would tell me where my science errors were. So I guess you could say I crowdsourced the fact checking.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that was really, really smart of you to do it because, you know, you could have 100 people look at it with different expertise, and, you know, that made a lot of sense.
And we do that with every episode of our show.
100 nerds.
Well, you must have had more latitude with a book like this because it obviously has thing, you know, whereas The Martian could be more of a contemporary piece, but this one obviously takes place in a more distant future.
No, this one takes place modern day.
Oh, it is. It's contemporary as well.
Yeah. Well, this is a thing that happened to Earth. It was like,
Was the toughest thing to research? What bit of the science to you was like the most interesting, but also, you know, what was hard?
It's funny because the thing that was hardest to research and most interesting, the answer to your question is quantum physics, I had to study a lot of because I went way down the rabbit hole, going all the way down as to design the biological functions happening inside of the astrophage. Ooh. And so I decided how they store energy is they turn kinetic energy of protons colliding into each other. That kinetic energy energy is turned into neutrinos. So they basically turn heat into neutrinos. Then they have the ability to contain the neutrinos, which requires their cell membrane to be something that can't be quantum tunneled through. So it experiences something called super cross-sectionality. And so here I am, like, all the way down in the quantum realm. Dude. And this is all for, like, what ends up being, like, one sentence in the book.
It's worth it. It's worth it. I mean, containing neutrinos that could travel through light years of lead without hitting anything. That's a feat.
That's impressive.
Super cross-sectionality.
I got to look that one up.
Yeah.
All right.
No, so I made it up.
You win a Nobel Prize. You win a Nobel Prize for inventing that.
That's good.
I'm sure I would.
Invent your own branch of quantum mechanics. I love it. But the astrophages, I'm just so fascinated. I mean, the whole industries would be built up around those damn things. You know, your power source. What other power sources do you need?
Right,
Screw fusion.
Exactly.
Oh my God, it's epic.
So yeah, I was there's a character in there who's just this kind of crazy Canadian space probe designer, and the character's name is Steve Hatch. I usually have a tough time remembering my minor characters' names, but I remembered him. And he's this bubbling optimist in the book. And I mean, he's only in one scene, but he's like, astrophage is the greatest thing ever. And people are like, it might kill all of humanity. He's like, well, sure that. But this is like, if we get a handle on this, it's like, that's it. We have basically an unlimited supply of clean energy.
And it's super efficient. How efficient were they?
They do mass conversion. So
But I remember reading about, you know, mass conversion and how it's, people say, oh, it's 100% conversion. It's not. It's not 100% efficient. It's from what my research was. So we could never use it to really get super, super close to the speed of light. Well, but it's just still incredibly efficient.
If you're saying efficiency in terms of what percentage of the mass is turned into energy.
Right.
For astrophage, it's way up in the 90s because they're storing the energy as neutrinos. Neutrinos are Majorana particles, which means they are their own antimatter.
Yes.
If two neutrinos collide, which doesn't happen often, they'll annihilate. And so just by storing it as neutrinos and then forcing them to collide, because of supercross-sectionality, shut up, they annihilate and turn into two photons, because you have to turn into two photons to keep the momentum balance correct on the equation.
Right.
And what's cool is I even went like, oh, okay, if they're going to annihilate and turn into photons and those photons are the propulsion, what wavelength are those photons? Well, that's based on the amount of energy in a neutrino. And that's based on the mass of a neutrino. And so I called my friend Chuck Duba, who is Dr. Charles Duba, who was on a team that won the Nobel Prize for dramatically narrowing down the known weight of a neutrino.
Yeah, but what does he know? Go ahead.
He was also a high school buddy of mine, which is
oh my God,
so
awesome.
Yeah.
So that's where the Petrova frequency came from? That was a real number?
That is a real number. That is, if you were able to mass convert a neutrino into a photon, well, two neutrinos into two photons, then you would get that frequency of light. It's in the infrared band.
Cool.
Andy, what if you had like a jetpack with a trillion of those damn things in the jetpack? Could you? How much lift would you get?
Well, you'd die because
But before you died, what kind of lift would you get?
It depends on. It's just how many of them do you want to activate at once, right?
All of them.
But their propulsion is light, so in order to get any sort of reasonable amount of force, you've got to be throwing a lot of light out the back.
Yes.
And if you do that in an atmosphere, you're just going to make a big fireball that vaporizes everything. Well, okay, everything so except the astrophage. It likes heat.
So it'll make a really good weapon then.
Again, if you like the idea of, I mean, it could make a pretty good bomb, but it wouldn't make a very good gun because, you know, if you're shooting really, really incredibly huge amounts of infrared light out the front of your gun, you're just going to ionize the air right there and vaporize yourself.
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
Yeah, no, last Thursday I did that. It sucked.
Andy, do you remember what was your first inspiration for the book? Like, where did the idea of the whole thing start in your head?
So the book that I was working on between The Martian and Artemis was Zhek, as I mentioned earlier. And in Zhek, there was, I mean, Zhek was a soft sci-fi space opera style story, and there were aliens all over the place and stuff. And there was this alien technology called black matter, and black matter would do that. It would mass convert, and it would actually propel a ship with like the cosmic rays or gamma rays or whatever. So the propulsion itself, the photons that it used would just pass harmlessly through you and stuff. But it had a feature of any electromagnetic radiation that hit it, it would convert into mass. And so they would, you know, farm up. If you had any black matter, you could farm more black matter and stuff like that. So when I was working on Project Hail Mary, I was like, well, that's a cool technology, but humans would never invent it. However, what if they found it? Well, they could find it, but then why does it exist? Was it made by aliens? Oh, no. You know what? It sounds a lot like life. It uses energy to make more of itself. That's the same thing we do indirectly. And so, yeah, so it'll be a life form, and that's kind of where that came from.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool of you to take the risk of having your protagonist not necessarily be, you know, an incredible Boy Scout, right? It was a very different person that you put up in front of us, but I thought that was a really good and ballsy thing of you to do.
Oh, thanks. I'm always trying to get better as a writer, and my characters are where I'm weakest, I think. So I'm trying to make them deeper, more complicated, more flawed, complex, etc.
All right, now two words, audiobook and movie.
Go. Audiobook. It's already been recorded. It releases the same time as the main book, May 4th.
Who narrated it?
I don't know when this is going to get aired, so May 4th may have already happened.
Yeah, it'll be next week, yeah.
Okay. And the narrator is Ray Porter.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm
yeah,
so
a little bit
there.
Came out, didn't it?
I'm yeah. so there. He is a god of narration. I wasn't daring to hope that it was going to be Porter. I'm just so psyched.
That's right. Rocks. Dark Side will be narrating.
Awesome.
And it's been optioned for a movie.
That not just optioned, but bought, which means they put more money into it. And so it means they're probably taking it more seriously, I hope. But anyway, it was bought by MGM. And we have Ryan Gosling attached to play the lead.
Oh, my yep. God, that's so cool.
It is cool because he has the same initials as Ryland Grace, yeah. So he could bring his own cufflinks to the set.
Oh, my God.
Then, we have Phil Lord and Chris Miller set to direct.
That sounds awesome.
That is awesome. Andy, this
yeah,
is
the whole time. The whole time I was reading this book, I'm thinking, I can't wait to see this rendered in a movie.
Yeah,
this is awesome.
Andy, yeah, you didn't fly out to the set for The Martian, right? Because it was too far away. But I hope you go
Martian
this time.
Far away, man.
I will for sure this time. I have not conquered my fear of flying. I'm still very much afraid of flying, but now I have pills that make it okay.
Yes, yeah, that's what nice. I do. Medicate yourself into oblivion, and you're good. Yep.
I become a non-entity.
Yes, yeah,
we had MGM interested in our book, but then you know Ryan Gosling dropped out, and like the whole thing.
Right.
Well, good, Andy. Good luck. You know, we will go see the movie a couple of times to show our support. I'm sure it's going to be awesome, and we are looking forward to your next project.
Thanks so much.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, although these are all news items. The theme is animal senses. Happen to be multiple news items dealing with animal senses. All right, here we go. Item number one. Recent research finds that bats are born with an innate sense of the speed of sound and judge distance entirely by time. Item number two, a new study in mice finds that the mammalian brain is able to process olfactory information much faster than previously thought, with mice able to detect a 10-millisecond odor pulse. Item number three, while previously thought to be colorblind, octopuses have recently been found to have 6 distinct photoreceptors for color vision. Bob, go first.
So bats with an innate sense of the speed of sound. Makes sense, I think. I could buy that one. Then we got the, let's see, I didn't really hear this full thing. New study of mice finds that the 10-millisecond odor pulse. Yeah, I mean, humans olfactory is crap. But other mammals, I mean, I remember reading once 70% of the genes that encode the sense of smell have like been mutated beyond function for humans. It's just like pathetic. So yeah, so that one I can 10 milliseconds, sure. This one though, the next one though, the octopus is colorblind. I mean, they found how many? 6 distinct photoreceptors. I mean, I would have think they would have found that by now. So I'm going to call bullshit on that one. Say that's fiction.
Okay. Jay?
Nuts. Okay, let's go to the first one. Research finds that bats are born with an innate sense of the speed of sound. I think that makes perfect sense, right? That they factor that in to their movements and being able, you know, they have to eat insects that are super tiny. Like, they need that kind of precision. That makes total sense. That's science. The mammalian brain is able to process the olfactory information much faster. All right, this is cool. So if I paint the picture of this in my head, like they would change the odor and they can register it in 10 milliseconds. If they feed them an odor and in 10 milliseconds their brain deciphered it.
No, that's not how long it takes. It's the odor itself only lasts for 10 milliseconds and they can detect it.
Whoa, that's even cooler. Super brief odor. Like the,
but that also for, that also means that you know the odor could be changing that quickly and they'd be able to detect it.
Yep, okay. All right, that's very cool. 10 milliseconds. Okay, well, I mean, that's fast, man. I could totally see the advantage to that. So, you know, makes sense. Okay, then move on to the last one. This is octopuses have recently been found to have 6 distinct photoreceptors for color vision, which means that they have amazing color vision. Now, I'm thinking of things like the depth that they exist at and the fact that colors get muted when you are at depth underwater. I'm going to say that one is science and that the mice mammalian photoreceptor, I mean, smell receptor one is fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I think I'm going to maybe go with Bob on this. I think I agree with both of the guys that bats need from the time that they're very young an ability. I just don't see how that could be a learned thing to be able to echolocate. You know, you need to know speed and sound, and learning something like that seems really complex. And so it's really between the mice. And so the 10 millisecond pulse, that is interesting, this idea that they can switch. I don't think people could do that. I do know that olfaction is relatively fast because it doesn't go through the thalamus the same way, or it doesn't always go through the thalamus the same way that almost every other sense does. But this idea of like fast switching is interesting. And then I'm like, that wouldn't work for people, I don't think. But then I'm like, whatever, mice are awesome and people suck when it comes to smelling. Like half of a mouse's brain is their olfactory bulbs. So not quite half, but it's a huge chunk of it. So that one kind of seems reasonable. The thing that bugs me is like, why would an octopus need to be able to see color? Like a ton of color. They're like deep under the water. That doesn't like grok for me in terms of an evolutionary trait. I would think being able to have really awesome rods would be important to see motion, hugely important to see shades of gray, hugely important. But like lots of just retinal space dedicated to cones seems wasteful from an evolutionary perspective. So I'm going to say that one's the fiction.
And Evan.
Plus, how do you go from you thought it was colorblind to suddenly 6 distinct photoreceptors? That's a leap. That's a huge leap. I mean, how could they have gotten that so possibly wrong? But for all the reasons Kara said, right, you know, you don't need it under the water like that. I think the octopus one is fiction.
So let's start with number one. Since you all agree on this, the recent research finds that bats are born with an innate sense of speed of sound and judge distance entirely by time. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. Yeah, this is pretty cool. So again, like they judge distance by time, meaning that the bat's brain is saying that bug is, you know, 0.2 seconds away, right? It's not 10 feet away. It's this number amount of time away. They think in terms of time because they're just thinking in terms of echolocation, if that makes sense, which means that they need to have, as a standard, they need to know how fast the sound is moving at baseline. So, yeah, and it makes sense. Yeah, echolocation is extremely important for them. So, they demonstrated that definitively. Okay, let's go on to number three. While previously thought to be colorblind, octopuses have recently been found to have 6 distinct photoreceptors for color vision. So I'm a little surprised at some of the comments you guys were making about that. So you're aware, right, that that a lot of octopuses can actually change their skin colors, and
yes,
they use
course.
It
yeah.
for signaling, and they use it for, you know, mating. So there's a lot of reasons why they would need to have color vision.
Right.
They don't have to be able to see what color they're changing to.
Well, they do if they're using it to signal for mates.
I don't know. Color can actually present as different shades, though.
Why don't you
like
just tell us?
Like shades of gray.
Right.
Yeah, just tell us what's
and
going
under
on.
The water,
what's happening?
Too. In the dark.
This one...
We got it.
...is the fiction, but not for the reason you think it is.
I love it when I get it right for the wrong reason.
Therefore...
But I was right about the polarized light sensitivity.
Yeah, so yeah, there are critters under the water that can see polarized light.
Mantis shrimp.
The mantis shrimp.
Right, but the question is it in their lens or is it an actual photoreceptor?
It's cone photoreceptors. I'm looking
cool.
at it right now.
That's nice.
Do you know how many different kinds of photoreceptors mantis shrimp have?
Like 15, 14 to 16.
22.
Yeah, right.
That's cool.
They're underwater.
They rock.
So that's another thing. Why would you think it's unusual for the octopus to have six when the mantis shrimp has 16?
I don't know. I didn't know the
I thought it was unusual because I thought we would have known. But I mean, they have a huge eye. No one took it apart.
Well, then why
and looked at the photoreceptors? It's the first thing I do.
Then why do you think they were colorblind?
They do. So we did think they were colorblind, and we did figure out that they do see in color.
Yeah.
But they see in color completely differently than we do.
Ooh, how?
How do you think?
Oh, so there's the rub.
They have one type of photoreceptor. But they're able to see color with one photoreceptor.
What?
What can it do?
I wonder if anybody can figure it out.
Well, you said it was completely different, so I don't know.
It's a completely different way that we do. What you remember what their pupils look like? They have like these
U-shaped pupils.
Or
yeah.
U-shaped pupils, so it's related to that.
Weird.
But you say here six distinct photoreceptors.
That's the lie. They don't. That's what makes it a fiction.
They only have one.
They have one photoreceptor, which is why we thought they were colorblind. But then we're like, but it didn't make sense because they definitely behaviorally see color. They behaviorally absolutely see color. So we had to figure out how they were seeing color, and then we did. And it has to do with the shape of their pupil. What do you think the pupil is doing to the light?
It's bending it.
It's splitting it into different colored light.
Oh, prism.
It's a prism.
It's got a prism in there.
That's cool.
So they only need one photoreceptor because they could split the light into red, green, blue.
Yeah, if you got a prism in your eye.
Okay, that's way cooler than them just
that octopi are alien. They're alien.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. They can choose to see in color or black and white by the way they reshape their lens and their cornea, right, their pupil. And so when they do split the light into different colors, it does make it a little blurry. So they could see like a wide field in color, but a little blurry, or they could focus in a narrow field in black and white and be really sharp.
Super sharp. Yeah.
Yeah. Like so that's
hunting or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how they can adjust their vision. But that's cool. They evolved a way to see color in a completely different way than vertebrates with only one photoreceptor. Yeah. That's cool. So all that means that a new study in mice finds that the mammalian brain is able to process olfactory information much faster than previously thought, with mice able to detect a 10-millisecond odor pulse is science. And that was surprising because it's a lot faster than we had previously thought. They also say that when they were looking at like the brain reaction of the mice, it was 10 milliseconds. But when they were looking at operant conditioning, they could respond to 40 hertz changes in odor. So it's 40 times per second, you know, so that's, you know, again, just down in the milliseconds. And so what this would give them the ability, being able to process odor that quickly means they could have a very complicated odor map of their environment. Like they could actually map out three-dimensionally where different odors are coming from and would give them a very complicated three-dimensional map of their smell environment, if you will. So very, what they call very fast temporal features in the odor stimuli.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really cool.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But back to octopuses. You said that we got it right for the wrong reasons, and that's incorrect. ma'am. That's
well,
incorrect.
I was like, I don't see why they would need to be able to see under the water at all.
Yeah, my point was that there's no way that they have multiple photoreceptors and we didn't know it. So I was right for the right reason. Just throwing that out there.
That part was correct. Kara was completely wrong. But totally your whole wrong. Discussion about my point, what I found surprising was your whole discussion, why would they need to see color? Which is wrong. They do need to see color. They do see color. There are lots of other, you know, why are all the fish so brightly colored? In the first
place. In tropical, and now that I think about it, it's like mostly in tropical reefs and in shallower waters.
Right.
Deep
right.
sea fish all just look like horrible, like skeleton monsters. But of course, octopuses are usually like you go tide pooling for octopus. Like that's where you're going to see them.
Yeah, they're shallow.
Very shallow.
Yeah. Well, come on. It's late and I'm tired. Yeah. I'm feeling very achromatopsic today.
Yeah, but octopuses are cool. They are.
Octopi.
They're the most intelligent invertebrates.
Yeah, they're
primates of the sea, they call them.
Yeah, basically. Hmm. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Okay, so tonight's quote needs a little bit of context. So, 16 years, guys, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
16 years. You know what I did? I looked up 16-year anniversary online. You know that there are gifts that you
that
a spouse will give to each other, right? On their depending on the year, you know, we've probably read about
it's all scam, but
exactly right. It's an excuse
what'd you get
product.
Me, Evan?
All right, well, what do you think the 16-year anniversary gift is?
Well, Bob said cardboard, or was that
cardboard.
Jay?
It's not cardboard.
Carpet. Vacuum cleaner. Oh no, it's usually some sort of material, right?
Right, copper. It's a material.
Packing bubbles.
Copper.
Well, Bob is kind of getting on
what
the
packing plastic
away.
Is 16
unobtainium.
Jay, any guesses?
I said wood pulp.
Wood pulp, not bad, not bad. The answer is wax.
What?
Oh,
wax. I guess
like
a candle.
But why? Yeah,
exactly right. Or you know, go polish your car.
Why, Jay? Because they're all made up.
Exactly right. Who knows?
Yeah, why? There is no why. There's only buy.
That's so good. So, that's our next t-shirt. Nice.
So I scoured the internet for quotes having to deal with wax. And that came up very short. Because
you would imagine.
It's not slim pickings out there for for things having to do. Okay, but if I expanded my search a little bit to include how homonyms. The word wax is used. So not just the material, but like a waxing moon, right? The waxing So I expanded it and I came across a few things. But so here's a quote with wax in it, and it's just for the four of you from me. Rich gifts wax poor when givers prove unkind. That's from Hamlet, Act 3, Hamlet. Scene 1, Ophelia talking to Hamlet.
I really like that.
Yeah. So a little bit of waxing poetic, as it were, right, for you.
Yeah. Ophelia was a snarky wench.
Yeah.
Alrighty then.
She was. I like the quote because it reminds you that, you know, it's about, look, you have to be kind. You know, the quality of the person is what's important. It doesn't, you know, if you get a gift from someone who's a jerk, you know, well, okay, they're still a jerk and you shouldn't judge them by the gift they're giving you. It's about the person, the quality of the person. That's what that quote means to me. And to me, you are, the four of you are some of the most quality people I've ever had the pleasure of knowing in my entire life.
Well, thank you,
thank
brother.
You.
Thanks, bro. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. It has been a lot of fun going on this skeptical journey with all of you guys.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wouldn't have traded it for anything else in the world. And I'm so looking forward to the next 16 years and beyond.
Right?
Sign I think up. So. Why not? Yeah, we'll keep going. Sure.
Sign me up. As long as my brain still works, I'll be here.
Absolutely.
that's key.
All right, guys. So thank you all for joining me for the last 16 years and this week.
Sure, man. Thank you, Steve, and
thanks,
everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.